your friend.
Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we review Manhattan Theatre Club's production of The Father. Jan catches us up with her reviews of Blackbird, Bright Star, Dry Powder, and Kings. Michael is just back from D.C. where he saw 110 in the Shade at the Ford's Theater, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at the Roundhouse Theater. Listener Debbie Schrager calls in with a review of I Am Anne Hutchinson, I Am Harvey Milk. And finally, we wrap up with off-Broadway productions of Antillia Pneumatica at Playwrights Horizons, Revolt, She Set Revolt Again at Red Bull, and School of Scandal at the Lucy Lortel. Finally, Straight at the Claremont. Please stay tuned. Welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 24, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantiere and Jan Simpson. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael. Oh, Michael, totally unrelated to I Am Anne Harada, during the opening segment, we didn't talk about Sound of Musicals.
Oh, yes. Our second edition has just been published, and it's me offering a review with excerpts of some of my favorite recordings of one of my favorite of all time shows, The King and I. So you can definitely check that out on Broadway Radio.
Also with us is Jan Simpson. Jan is the co-director of the Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism and also writes for TDF Stages and Playbill. Good morning, Jan.
Hi.
Hello. Peter is not with us today. He is actually in a meeting of the Drama Desk, executive committee or some sort of thing about this. But Michael, you're a member of the Drama Desk, right?
Yes, and I believe it's the nominating committee that Peter is now on. Isn't that right?
Something along those lines. And
so.
Jan, you are not a member of the Drama Desk.
I am not.
You're an OCC member and a Tony voter.
I am.
So you won't know about this, Jan, but Michael and I know about this, is that the first rule of Drama Desk is that we don't talk about Drama Desk. Let's see if anybody gets that reference. All right. So Jan, Michael, and I got a chance to see The Father, which is playing over at Manhattan Theater Club's Samuel J. Friedman Theater. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, this is not the play by Strindberg, although Frank Langella did that play, I think not that long ago on Broadway. This is a new play by Florian Zeller, and I believe it was written in French. I believe he is French. And it's about this main character named Andre, played by Frank Langella, and his daughter. And there are several other characters in the play. And it's really quite a wonderful, very moving play about this fellow succumbing to Alzheimer's disease in its advanced stages as the play progresses. I would advise – I don't always do this, and in this case I regretted it. I did not actually read closely the cast of characters before the play started, and it would have helped me because what the playwright does in this play – and it's really, really very effective – although I have some questions about it, and I'm not sure it was completely successful, but overall it's very effective. What he does is that he basically places us in the mind of Andre, in that we see him confusing people with other people, confusing events, not remembering things correctly. We never really know. It's hard to tell, at any rate, what is true and what is not. For example, at one point, his daughter is played by one actress, Catherine Irby. And then we see another woman who is supposedly his daughter, and we're not sure if that's supposed to be the same daughter or his other daughter whom he refers to. Then at one point we hear that the daughter, Anne, is planning to move from Paris to London to be with a man she's met. In the next scene, she's not moving to London, and she says, "I never said I was moving to London." There are two different people we see as her, the man that she's in love with, and or her husband. There is a woman who plays a housekeeper who is hired. But then later on, we see another woman as the housekeeper. And I could go on and on. I think you have the idea. So the reason I say that it would help to read the cast list, cast of characters in this case, is the way that they are listed. Anne, who is who seems to be the daughter who is present in Andre's life, is played by Catherine Irby. Andre, Frank Langella. Then it says further down, it says Laura Hannah Cabell, who is the woman who. The first woman who we see being hired to be the housekeeper, or the not housekeeper, you know, the companion to help him in his condition around the house. Yeah, exactly. Aid. Thank you. But then the other people are listed as man, played by Charles Borland, a woman, played by Kathleen McNenny, and then there is one other character, Pierre, played by Brian Avers. So if I had read the list beforehand and seen that Charles Borland and Kathleen McNenny were listed as man and woman, I guess that would have cued me in to the fact of who is actually who and who is not. And that might have helped a little in understanding what was exactly was happening. But on the other hand, the point is sort of that you don't understand exactly what's happening, because you're meant to experience the breakdown of Andre's faculties. And I really thought overall, as I say, there were moments when I thought it was a little too confusing and maybe not completely successful. One of the reviews that I read after seeing the show said that that reviewer said he felt it wasn't completely successful because he said there was at least one scene where Andre was not on stage, and yet we also had that kind of shifting reality happening. I don't remember that specifically, but I'll take that reviewer's word for it. But overall, it really was very moving and effective, and also, you know, very frightening and unnerving in a way, as you might imagine. Frank Langella is superb in it. I did have a technical issue. He is playing the role with a very pronounced British accent, even though the man is supposed to be French and the action is supposed to take place in Paris. I can only think that he did that because he thought that would be preferable to American, although everyone else truly sounds American. So yeah. I'm not sure why they didn't get all on the same page as far as that. I think Doug Hughes didn't think it was important or didn't think it was necessary to challenge Mr. Langella in his choice of using a British accent. It did kind of take me out of the play, because I swear it was I thought at some point there was going to be some explanation as to why he had a British accent. I thought they were going to say, well, you know, ever since you moved here from England. But that never happened. And it did kind of bother me until I finally figured out, well, all right, he's just doing that because he thinks it sounds better for the character. In every other way, he's quite extraordinary. And I'm so, so glad to have seen him again on stage. I many shows I've seen him in, and he's always been excellent, even in cases where you know, other aspects of the production have not been. But this play is very, very much worth your while, and it's a playwright that I think we should all keep our eye on. By the way, the translation is by Christopher Hampton, and the playwright again is Florian Zeller.
So Jan, what did you think about this?
Oh, I agree with just about everything Michael said. I found it, though, very uncomfortable to sit through.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Oh,
yeah.
And I thought it really recreated what that experience must be. And I thought it was particularly impressive because the playwright seems to be like in his 30s. And so to have this kind of insight, perhaps someone in his family went through this experience. And I also thought it was a beautiful performance, but also a very courageous performance, because the character of Andre is 80 and Frank Langella is 78. And so to have to recreate each night the breakdown of an older man. Frank Langella is not broken down at all. He's very vigorous, very sharp at the top of his game. But to have to go through that experience each night, it was wrenching for me just watching it one night. I can't imagine what it's like for him doing this night after night. It's really, really an incredible, I thought, performance.
Something I noticed is it's not really till the very end that we see him becoming very, very upset by what is happening to him. And I think that just made it more effective. If that had been the case throughout the play, I think it would have been maybe too hard to watch and also less effective when we see it at the end. So I think that was a very wise choice.
Well, I thought when he, you know, the way he was putting on a face,
right,
when he was caught out in confusions, in lies, I think that is very much the way people who are losing control do act. Oh, I made a mistake, or,
right,
you know, I didn't really mean that, of course. And that I found just so poignant. I don't know how to recommend this to people, because I think it's a terrific performance and a really moving play, but like really difficult to watch,
yes,
very painful.
So I was talking with one of our listeners, Josh Ellis, and we were talking right before I went to see the show, and he said he had seen it and that it was very difficult because he had just been through something similar with his parents. Mm. And we talked about my dad, who just passed away about a year ago, in the early stages of Alzheimer's. And it was interesting what people take away from the show, because you go in and this is not going to be a feel-good evening no matter, you know, and that's not the point of this show. So this is a very very uncomfortable to sit through, but not uncomfortable because it's a bad show. It's uncomfortable because of the topic and how it affects each and every person in the audience. And I was wondering maybe that this affected the audience that I was sitting in when I saw it last week. The MTC audience is not a young audience.
Yeah.
And it was very the audience was really restless and really rude. And
yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And we had people get up and walk out of the show in the middle of a scene, you know, from down front, you know, right up the center aisle out of the theater. And and so I wonder if it was a combination of this being just too uncomfortable for them, or what happened there. And
I just occurred to me that there are at least two other plays on Broadway at the moment that fall into this category of really excellent experiences that are extremely hard to sit through because of
Blackbird.
The subject matter. Blackbird and Eclipsed.
Yeah.
And for that matter, The Crucible.
Crucible, I was going to say, know? Yeah.
I mean, great drama frequently is like that.
What I found interesting with my audience is that even in this show, there is some humor.
Yeah.
And the audience just seemed to leap on the humor and over-respond to it. And I think, you know, people just needed a release.
Oh, sure.
So what did you guys think about this seemingly technique or metaphor of using the furniture on stage?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask about the lights flashing in
the face. The lights are coming up on the lights.
I did.
Is on my list.
Okay. Well, the furniture. Well, see, that's. I was trying to. I guess this is natural. In the beginning, I was trying to analyze exactly what was real and what wasn't. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it seemed to always be in the same space, but they were referring to Andre at sometimes being in his flat, sometimes being his daughter's flat. And I guess it that was just part of, and parcel. And then furniture starts to move, furniture starts to disappear.
The thing that annoyed me about it was that in my experience, excuse me, that this wasn't what Alzheimer's was about.
Well, I said that too. And I said to my friend who I went with, do Alzheimer's people specifically do things like mistaking one daughter for another?
Yeah. I mean, it's old memories are more prevalent than new memories and not mistaken memories.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that's true. I think that's generally true that a lot of them have long-term memory and not short-term. But I think it's a lot more complicated than that. And I know that this friend said that he has a friend who's in the actor's home, and he'll go visit him, and you know there'll be a woman helping him out, and then she'll come back in 10 minutes later, and he'll say, "Who's that?" Now that's all short-term memory.
Yeah.
But I do think that it can also affect the long-term. It's not so cut and dried. I think that's the answer to your question.
And then the lights. The lights.
Well, which are I've gone on record many times before saying how much I hate having very, very bright lights shown in my face. In this case, there one interpretation is that it's meant to indicate synapses of the brain misfiring. Yeah. And I can appreciate that intellectually, but I still hated it.
Oh, I liked it. I thought
you did?
I thought it disoriented me in that same way of, you know, one moment you're here, one moment you're there. It worked for me.
I think I just didn't need to have them directly in my eyes.
Yeah.
Because
I would have done a wash over the stage. I felt like they were using that to wake up the audience.
Well, maybe that too.
I never thought
it'll
of that.
Be in every show at the Manhattan Theater Club now. I should put it into the roundabout next.
Well, let me add. I think this play as a play was vastly superior to the last play they did there, Our Mother's Brief Affair, which really was the kind of the bottom of the barrel as far as playwriting. Mm-hmm. So let's take the good where we find.
Yeah. Well, aren't you Polly Posit?
Yeah, in a way.
All right. So we are fortunate that Jan was available and stepped in for Peter. And Jan has seen a bunch of things that we have reviewed about before, but I'd love to get Jan's take on a number of these things. We mentioned Blackbird for a second. So Jan, why don't you tell us quickly what you thought about Blackbird?
I didn't like it as much as I did when I saw the Manhattan Theater Club production, and I think it's a factor of Alison Pill was in the first production I saw, and Michelle Williams in this, and I just preferred Alison Pill's interpretation of the role.
I had the same reaction.
On the same page, all of us.
And
yeah.
I forget, yeah, I guess all three of us, right?
Yeah, and Bright Star. What did you think of Bright Star?
I thought it was a nice musical. I enjoyed it. It was fine, but there was nothing that made it really take off for me. And I was confused by the choreography. I didn't really get why all those people were dancing around who didn't seem to be in the show. I didn't have real roles. I couldn't really figure out the choreography. It was very distracting.
Down at the Public Theater, you saw Dry Powder that we talked about a few weeks ago, which was the financial play with Claire Danes.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw Dry Powder, and I saw another play by the same playwright, Sarah Burgess, as part of the Women's Project's the Pipeline Festival. This was the first year of the Pipeline Festival. It ended yesterday. It was weekly semi-productions of plays by women, the Women's Project, that happened on the weekends. So it was, I think, you know, like three or four performances on the weekend. This program that the Women's Project has, this Pipeline Project, puts together women directors, women playwrights, and women producers to work together and to create these mini productions. So I went not knowing what exactly I was going to see. I thought it might be just a reading. It was a pretty fully staged performance of Sarah Burgess's play Kings. The people who were in the play were Quincy Tyler Bernstein, Larry Pine, Charles Socarides, and Jessica Love. So really accomplished, significant theater actors. And the plays were similar, Dry Powder and Kings. Dry Powder, obviously taking place in the world of finance, high-powered finance, and Kings taking place in the realm of political operatives in Washington. And it seems to me in both plays, Burgess is interested. I guess the question she sort of sits down, she asks herself is, okay, what's the price? Hmm. What's the price at which you are willing to sell out, to sell your integrity? And she seems to think that sometimes the price is very high, but that everybody has a price. Hmm. And I think the plays maybe need to be she's a young playwright, and so her writing, I think, will deepen and strengthen as she continues to work. But I think her head is really interesting. The fact that she's not just writing relationship plays or, you know, sort of the basic in the living room kind of plays, that she's really looking at the way people interact, the way power works, is really interesting. I wasn't totally knocked out by the cast at Dry Powder, even though it's a really glitzy cast of Hank Azaria, Claire Danes, John Krasinski. I thought Hank Azaria was the most impressive to me. It's also kind of weird. I don't know if you guys have had this experience. I mean, we go to the theater a lot, all of us, and I'm used to hearing people talk about the play or talk about the performances as you're walking out. And at this performance, and even at, although I know we're not going to talk about Long Day's Journey because it hasn't opened, even when I saw Long Day's Journey, people were talking about the TV shows the actors were on.
I was just going to say that when, especially with celebrity type plays, they talk about the celebrity, not about the play.
Yeah, it was very strange. I mean, as opposed to debating the themes that the playwright was exploring or whether or not people thought the performance was right, people were going, yeah, I really liked her on Homeland. Oh, I've loved her since My So-Called Life. Oh, who does Hank Azaria play on The Simpsons? I mean, it was all like that. It was, it was, yikes. It was, I'm sounding, I don't know, a little bit elitist, but it was just sort of strange.
I'm sorry to hear that. There was actually a talk back after the performance that I attended, but I couldn't stay. I wish I had. It seemed to me that people were engaged in the story as well. But, you know, I mean, everyone is different, and maybe you just heard the wrong people talking. I mean, it's certainly
I definitely did.
All right. So that catches us up a lot with what Jan has seen. Michael, you just got back from a trip last week. You were out of the city last weekend down in D.C. where you got to see a few shows. Let's talk about the first one is 110 in the Shade at the Fords.
Yeah, I was really lucky. I tend to be very lucky in my D.C. theater trips. Hardly anything I've seen has not been great. So I hope I keep up my track record.
Now you've jinxed yourself.
Although, let me talk about 110 first. This was an excellent production. I went primarily, this trip was primarily to see this show because I really do love it, and it's not done all that often. 110 in the Shade by Tom Jones and Harvey Schmidt, based on The Rainmaker by N. Richard Nash. And I went also because I knew Ben Crawford, the work of Ben Crawford, who was playing Starbuck. So you can imagine my disappointment when I got there. And actually what happened was the night before I left on Facebook, a friend of mine who's in the show, Michael Yeshin, in the ensemble, posted a Facebook message about how two understudies on this weekend because I said, well, who's it? What happened? And he said Ben Crawford had a leg injury and was not going on. And so at first I was, oh, man, really? But as it turns out, his understudy, who normally plays the role of Jimmy, one of Lizzie's brothers, is Gregory Mayhew, who I really, really like his work as well. He, although I've only seen him in one or two things before, primarily he was spectacular in 1776 at Ford's Theater some years ago. James, this was the production with Bob Cuccioli and Brooks Ishmanskas
and
Kate Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And in that production, Greg played Rutledge and Molasses to Rum. And that was the first time I saw him, and I was like, who is this guy? So as soon as I heard that he was the understudy, I was like, oh, well, you know, all right, maybe that this won't be so bad after all. And he was just great in it. Now, he seemed a little not right physically for the role because he was not supposed to be playing it. So he, who was supposed to be playing the younger brother of Lizzie. And so he had, for example, his hair was very short cut and he had no facial hair at all. And there are things he might have done if he were actually signed to play Starbuck, I think that would have made him look more as we picture the character. But aside from that, his acting was so great and his voice is so gorgeous. He's one of those people who have an operatic quality voice, but it doesn't have any of the stodginess or any of the the trained quality that opera voices sometimes have in musical theater. He really was great. And so I wound up I'm sure Ben Crawford would have been magnificent in the part and he got great reviews, and who knows, maybe I'll try to get back down and see him in again. But as it turned out, it was really kind of special because obviously I was one of very few people who got to see Greg Mayhew in the part. And I think he only went on for one entire weekend, of which one performance was the one that I caught. So he was great. And question?
I was going to interrupt you for a second before you moved on to the next show. Mm-hmm. Or are you still have something to say about 110?
Oh, well, just I have to mention Tracy Lynn Oliveira, who played Lizzie. She was really wonderful, too. And the guy who played File, Kevin McAllister. I'd never seen or heard him before, but he was spectacular. He was African-American, and it seemed to work really well in that role. But also, there again, the main thing about him was his beautiful, gorgeous opera quality voice. So I'm very, very, very thrilled that I saw it. It was Marcia Milgram Dodge directing. And I really, it goes through May 14th, and I may try to get back down there again to see it with Ben Crawford.
So off topic, I was going to mention that that Glenn Close is out of Sunset Boulevard over in London.
Oh, I saw.
She's sick, and the understudy went on, and people were booing in the audience. And she seemed to have won them over, as often happens with an understudy, which is, you know, so sad that they were such rude people to boo her, you know. But that
she, I didn't read that part. That's awful. You mean while she was?
Yeah.
Or do you mean when it was announced that she was going on?
Well, I wasn't there. Okay. So all I can do is report what social media says, and that's always correct. So so in social media, they said that people booed when she came out on stage.
Oh, if that's true, that is.
And that's disgraceful. And she, it says, Jones, a Welsh singer, was faced furious boos and walkouts, and it was announced that Close was unwell, with audience members paying up to £150 to see the American actress left disappointed, but that at the end she won over the audience and she took 5 curtain calls.
Which is lovely.
That is wonderful. Yeah. And so we'll have to keep up on what's happening with Sunset Boulevard in London and more rumblings that it's going to come back to New York. People starting, you know, New York producers getting on planes, I hear. So we'll see what happens there. Next up, Michael also saw Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at the Roundhouse Theater in Bethesda, Maryland. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Yes, another really great production. I come to think of it, one of the less satisfying Cats I had seen was in 2004 at the Kennedy Center, a production with Mary Stuart Masterson and Jeremy Davidson. And I'm not sure what it wasn't their fault. It was a combination of things in that case. Oh, George Grizzard was Big Daddy, and Dana Ivey was Big Mama in that production at the Kennedy Center. So there was nothing wrong with the cast, but it just didn't gel somehow. The play does have flaws, as I pointed out in the past. I think it's overwritten to a certain degree. A lot of information is repeated more than it needs to be, but when you see a really wonderful production like this present one at the Roundhouse Theater in Bethesda, Maryland, I think the flaws seem to become much less important. I would have to say overall, this was the best production I've ever seen. There might have been individual things that were better, elements that were better in previous productions, but overall, as a solid statement of the play and no major flaws, it was really, really wonderful. There was one actor I knew slightly, Gregory Waddell. He had been in The Lions when they did The Lions here with Linda Lavin a few years ago. Mm-hmm. He played the real estate agent.
Right. Yeah.
You remember? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I knew him from that alone. And then there's the actor who played Big Daddy in this production, Rick Fouchot, is a fixture down in D.C. So I knew his work and I knew he was excellent. And actually, while I was sitting there waiting for this performance to start, the people in back of me, one of the women seemed to know D.C. theater pretty well. And I think she said that he's retiring. So that'll be a loss to the theater down there. But I'm glad I got to see him in this. It was really – he was great. Gregory Waddell was great as Brick. This woman I'd never heard of before, Alyssa Wilmoth Keegan, was fantastic as Maggie. The chemistry between all of them – oh, and I have to mention Sarah Marshall as Big Mama, brilliantly directed by this guy, Mitchell Ebert, H-E-A-G-U-B-E-R-T. Wonderful set.
I was going to say, did he do anything particularly different to just lift it to the heights for you?
I think it was the everything gelled, Jan. It seemed like everyone really were those people, and that they had the relationships with each other. The director's part of it was the pacing was really good, and it needs to be kept up because, as I said, it can get very repetitious. Gregory Waddell made very interesting choices about Brick. That can be such a difficult role because he's so morose for the whole first act, and then he's drinking steadily throughout the play, and some people overplay the drunkenness, and then it becomes unbearable. But he found more like kind of sarcasm and anger and even some humor in it. Again, this Alyssa Wilmoth Keegan woman, she's not the most stunningly beautiful woman I'd ever seen, but she really seemed to inhabit the character. And I was so pleasantly surprised to see such a fantastic production in, you know, this sort of off the beaten path regional theater. So that one is I think, going for several more weeks also. If you at all find yourself in DC, try to catch both of these. Even though this Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is in Bethesda, it's only like 15 minutes on the metro, and then a 5 walk from the metro stop. So really, really great work. One negative thing to throw it, the only negative thing I have to say about the production, they in the lobby, they had some really informative posters, displays about various aspects of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, the writing of it, the times in which it was written, Tennessee Williams' life, etc. And then there was one panel about censorship, and with a big, big, beautiful close-up photo of Elizabeth Taylor, who of course played Maggie in the movie. And it talked about how in the movie, which is otherwise phenomenal, they did have to cut out all of the subplot about Brick possibly having been in love with his friend Gooper. And so they talked about that, and they talked about that. And then suddenly at the end of the paragraph, it suddenly said something about how and Tennessee Williams always said that Elizabeth Taylor was never his idea of Maggie. Now, so I said to myself, first of all, what does that have to do with censorship? And second of all, why take a swipe at an iconic film performance in the lobby of a theater that's doing the show? It reminds me of that hateful thing that Mark Shenton wrote for the program of Gypsy when Patti LuPone did it, going on and on about how Ethel Merman was not an actress. I cannot tell you how much I hate that and how disrespectful I find it. I'm very surprised at that Roundhouse did this, but of course I don't know who was responsible for that display. And I'm going to actually send them this podcast and tell them that was the only negative thing I found about the production, and I hope they will avoid doing things like that in the future.
With us today, we have a special guest, Debbie Schrager, who is a listener from the DC area, has joined us to talk about and give us a review on I Am Anne Hutchinson, I Am Harvey Milk, which the folks here in New York are not able to get down to that to see it. So Debbie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So tell us about I Am Anne Hutchinson, I Am Harvey Milk. Where is it playing first?
It is playing at the Strathmore Music Center, which is just outside D.C. in North Bethesda.
And this was a benefit performance?
I think, in part, I think that there is some benefit to the production for Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, and also for the National Women's History Museum. So in part, I think the proceeds are for those benefits.
And it was starring that dynamo Kristen Chenoweth, right?
Indeed.
So give us your review. What did you think of this production?
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I don't know whether you'd like to hear just a little bit of background.
Yeah, tell us that.
For those who may not know, I Am Harvey Milk was originally a standalone production that was commissioned in 2013 by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And it originally, there's a lead role for a soprano, a tenor, and then a child. And in that original production, the soprano was Laura Benanti. And this production has actually, I think, been done about 20 times independently. Notably, in 2014, the piece was done at Avery Fisher Hall. I don't know if either of you had seen it at that time, but that's when Chenoweth became part of the performance. And, you know, of course, she and Andrew Lippa are longtime friends and collaborators. I didn't know this until I just started doing my research, but he composed My New Philosophy for the 1999 Broadway production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which, of course, Chenoweth won her Tony for. I think that Lippa was interested in trying to create a sort of a more singular theater piece that could kind of stand on its own for an entire evening. And I think he sort of inadvertently came upon sort of the life of Anne Hutchinson, who I'm guessing some people may not be familiar with. Obviously, Harvey Milk is a well-known figure, especially after the 2008 movie. But she was a 17th century women's rights activist. She basically clashed with the Puritan authorities by having the audacity to teach women in her home. And, and this was at a time, of course, where women's inferiority and was sort of explicitly in Puritan doctrine. And she was tried for basically disturbing the peace, and she was then banished from her Massachusetts Bay colony where she lived and was excommunicated from the church. And her nemesis in this whole thing was the Massachusetts governor, John Winthrop, who in this production is portrayed by Lippa. And she ended up ultimately living in New York, where she was killed by a Native American massacre. But some may know that there's a Hutchinson River in southwest Chester County, New York, and a parkway, and those are actually named for her. So basically, you know, Lippa has tried to, you know, create some connections between sort of, you know, these civil libertarians of sort of the Puritan time and then, of course, Harvey Milk. But there was this practical aspect of this where both pieces allowed him to cast a tenor, a soprano, and a child, and then keep the ensembles. It's hard not to have sort of a towering production at Strathmore. If you haven't been there, and I don't know whether James or Michael, if either of you have been to Strathmore, but it is a... It was built about 15 years ago, and it's like close to a 2,000 seat concert hall that's just magnificent, and it's probably considered the best both acoustically and aesthetically in the region. You know, even better really than the Kennedy Center, and so already you have this sort of great venue. And this production was accompanied by the National Philharmonic. So you have a 36-piece orchestra. And then along with Chenoweth and Lippa, you had a 16-member all-male ensemble. And one of the big differences in this version of I Am Harvey Milk versus past productions was that this was really, staged. There was some costuming, some projections on the sides of the theater walls that were kind of nice, sort of invoking the Puritan setting or San Francisco. And I just want to give a little shout out to the choreographer. His name is Larry Keegwin. And, he did a lovely job of working, especially with the ensemble. So, you know, the first piece is just not as compelling as Harvey Milk, in part because in the second piece there was a 100-person all-male choir. So already it was a little bit less, less overwhelming. But I was so excited about seeing Chenoweth take on a very, she's such a brilliant comic performer, to take on sort of a darker role. And she really did not disappoint. She just was in fine voice. She did a beautiful job, and I really loved, seeing her in that type of role. It was odd, a little odd that she was costumed in a Puritan outfit and the male ensemble and Lippa were all in dark suits. And you could say, well, maybe, just the principals. But in the second half of the show, you know, the guys were all in, you know, jeans and white T-shirts. They were clearly, like, dressed for 70s gay San Francisco. So I'm not sure that that made as much sense to me. And also, but there were some funny things that were done, like, you know, if she was supposed to be preaching to a group of women, and the way they handled that was all the men sat with their backs to the audience, and then they flipped these signs onto their backs that said, Mrs. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so. So that was kind of funny. And I had no idea that Andrew Lippa could sing like that. He really has powerful tenor, and he did a great job as Governor Winthrop. And I think that, you know, the audience overall seemed to respond really strongly to the production, and it was very moving. But the second half, the I Am Harvey Milk piece, is really, you know, it's been through multiple performances, and now with the stage version, it is really, you know, a very exciting production, and I can't quite imagine being in the audience of this without being moved. Some highlights were, there's a song called I Am a Bullet, and basically the male ensemble is sort of, we are the bullet that embodied, we are embodying the bullet that went through the brain of Harvey Milk. And the way it was choreographed, they sort of moved as a unit. There's a fun number called Friday Night in Castro, which was sort of a fun disco anthem. And it was interesting. They all had colored bandanas, which I gathered, I learned afterwards, had some significant symbolism for the gay community, and people can look that up for themselves. You know, there was also a couple other numbers where they're singing about a decent society and sticks and stones, and there's lyrics like, I want to be a better than this mess of a man. You know, and then there's like this just repeated chanting of all these of gay slurs over and over again by, you know, and you have this 100 member chorus, 16 member ensemble, full orchestra, and they're just going sort of chanting them over and over again. And you can't, you know, it was heart wrenching. And I think I felt the pain from that community more than I had ever felt before after listening to that. It was really. And there was a lovely love song to San Francisco. Chenoweth returns in Puritan garb towards the end of the second piece, and I'm not sure that made a lot of sense to me. I mean, I guess he was trying to draw the connection, but it was certainly interesting to see a woman in Puritan dress singing the final number, which is called, you know, where everyone sings "Come out" and sort of chanting again, "Come out to your family, to your friends, to your colleagues," and. But overall, the production was just beautifully sung. Sometimes the orchestra was a little loud over Chenoweth. I guess that's Andrew Lippa was really, you know, just very clear, easy to hear. But when she was in her high register, you know, everyone was mesmerized. So overall, I was just thrilled to be in the audience.
Well, that's excellent. And this is you went last night, which was Saturday evening?
That's right. There's one more performance this afternoon at Strathmore, I think at 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
So everyone who wasn't celebrating their second Seder last night can go today.
I have a link to this production in the show notes, and there's a little bit more information about it, and also a video with Kristen and Andrew in it that I'll try to include in the show notes. So if this is something that is interesting to you, please check out our show notes, and you can get more information either at the Strathmore website, which is beautiful, or just from the video that's there. Debbie, thank you so much for calling in with a review of this performance. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
All right. Back in New York City, Jan got a chance to see, I'm going to hack this, Antilia Pneumatica?
I think it's Antlia.
Antlia Pneumatica,
yeah,
at Playwrights Horizon. So other than the title, tell us how it was.
This is a play by Anne Washburn, who did a few years ago. I'm going to blank on it. It's the play about the Simpsons.
A play about the television show?
Mr. Burns.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Mr. Burns play.
I don't remember the rest of the title.
At She did that at Playwrights Horizons, and it, a lot of people were very excited about it, and so we're very excited to see her next production. And this play is very different, but she also did earlier this year a play down at Soho Rep called 10 out of 12, which refers to the tech process that plays productions go through, where they can have people working for 10 hours out of every 12 hours. And her plays are never quite naturalistic. And this play, a lot of people have said it's similar to The Big Chill. Do you guys remember that movie, The Big Chill?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in this this play starts off with a group of people who went to college. One of their old gang has died. And this group of people haven't really kept in touch in the way that, you know, that any of us did when we were in school. But in his papers, in his will, he said he wanted them to come together. He wanted to be buried at this ranch. It takes place in Texas, at this ranch that was owned by the father of two of the girls in their group. And the father had been sort of like a big rock guy or country music. He was a big music star. And he left his ranch to his two daughters when he died. And I guess the college friends spent a lot of time there hanging out. And so he wants to be buried there. And so it starts off very naturalistically. Everybody's remembering the good old days and chatting and so on. And then very quickly it gets kind of surreal because someone arrives, and he arrives without a car. He's making references to people that some people think actually had died earlier. And so it's not clear. I mean, they know who he is. He was a member of their old gang, but they're not quite sure how he got there because none of them remember inviting him. And so it's this play about memory, roads not taken, relationships. Atlea Pneumatica turns out to be a constellation. I did not know that. It's a minor constellation, and there's a lot of looking at the stars, talking about the stars. I didn't personally. I didn't find it completely satisfying because it just kind of drifts off at the end. But very well performed. An interesting, I guess, just a meditation on again on growing older and choices one took and didn't take, and whether or not it's too late to make changes in your life.
All right.
So there.
Okay. You also got over to Soho Rep where you saw Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again.
This one is really wild. Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again is just 65 minutes, but they are jam-packed 65 minutes. It's written by a woman named Alice Birch. She says she was inspired by Valerie Solanas. I don't know if the name rings a bell for folks, but she's the woman, and Valerie Solanas is the woman who shot Andy Warhol in 1968. She also wrote this document that's called the Scum Manifesto, and the manifesto is about makes a case for getting rid of all men. And this play, what can I say? This play is a series of short scenes that take conversations conversations between men and women, conversations between a woman and her boss, one between a family setting where a woman is really having a conversation with her mother. And these, it's about words, how we use words to, how words are used to restrict women, confine women, and the women in this play decide not to be defined and so come back. The first scene is probably the easiest to describe and the easiest to get. And it takes place at a restaurant. This couple is out for dinner. They've had a great dinner. And the guy is looking forward to the rest of the evening. And he starts telling her how sexy she is, how great she is, how he can't wait to make love to her. And she says, "You mean love with me?" And she, by just that preposition, then starts taking over the conversation. And by the end of the conversation, where she's telling him what she's going to do to him in bed, and she gets very aggressive, very assertive, by the end of the conversation, he's just ready to go home, not with her. It's a very angry play. It takes place largely, it's down at Soho Rep, largely on a bare stage until the last scene, where they fill the space with a lot of different things, primarily plants, and then something happens at the end. Not fair to say what. It's a very bracing play. I'm still baffled by it. I can't say I liked it, but I was. It really set me thinking. Really, and I suppose that's a good thing.
Thinking is good. Yeah. Did you think much about School for Scandal?
I had a good time.
Well, we should say School for Scandal's down at the Lucy Lortel.
Yeah.
It's a Red Bill production.
Right, exactly. I had a good time. I've never seen it.
I'm hearing really good things about it. But what's interesting to me, I haven't seen it yet, but I saw they did a benefit. The Red Bull did a benefit of the play about half a year ago, maybe, with a completely different cast, including Charles Bush. And Everett Quinton as two of the women.
Oh, I bet that was a hoot.
Yeah. So I just find it interesting that they decided to go in a completely different way, direction for the actual production.
I think you'll have a good time. I mean, the audience that I saw it with, just you could tell, genuinely had a good time. And it was the kind of standing ovation that I love. It wasn't where everybody just jumped up and started applauding because they thought they should. There were people who stood up here and there because clearly they just wanted the actors to know that they really had a great time. Mm-hmm. And it was just fun. It was just silly fun. And everyone was, you know, in on the joke, led by Dana Ivey. You mentioned her, I think, Michael, earlier.
Yes.
And she comes on early in the production. When she comes on, she just lifts the playing field, the sort of, you know, establishes, okay, this is where we're going to be playing at. And then you just sort of sense the other actors saying, okay, we're in it and let's do it. And they are silly and funny. And what's really interesting to me, because I've never seen the play before, is that this, probably everybody else has seen it who's listening to this and already knows this, but this play was written in the 18th century by Sheridan, and his humor is so contemporary. You just see all of the beats of that people on, like, Saturday Night Live and other sketch shows, that all of the the sort of satire that they are doing today, really rooted right there in Sheridan's School for Scandal. Just great, great fun.
All right, and catching up with the last review of the morning, you saw Straight at the Clareman. So tell us about what you thought of Straight.
I really liked it. I know you guys have already talked about it, and I liked the fact that it was dealing with. It seemed, you know, like just another coming out play,
right.
But I thought it added just some depth to the argument, the discussion, and the whole idea of a person who doesn't want to be labeled. It seemed to me, in some ways, like Cock. Do you guys remember Cock a few years
yes.
ago, where you've got a guy who's involved with both a man and a woman, and his response is just that he's just responding to how he feels. It's not that he's he's just responding to what turns him on. And this guy, is more in agony, it seems to me, than the guy in Cock. And I think Cock was a better play. But I was just really impressed by the nuance of the argument. And the audience, again, was so with it. Obviously not giving away the ending, but people really gasped out loud towards the end. I thought it was really interesting. And I thought it was kind of interesting that it was written by two people.
Yes. Yeah, I noticed that.
Contrary to Two Toasters?
Well, yes.
The two is the operative word.
I'm sorry. I had to do it. No, it's too easy.
I set myself up. another part of what I liked I guess the entire creation of this character, because the idea that this was a guy who would be defined as a bro. A guy who likes his beer, likes watching his sports,
right. Right.
And just a reminder that there is no one definition of what a gay man might be. I liked that a lot too.
All right, so I think we're all caught up there right now. I have to. Offer apologies to some of our listeners because I did a poor producing job. I knew a week ahead of time that Peter wasn't going to be here this morning, and I forgot to get the update for the trivia question. So we will do that next week. But before we go, Michael's got two anecdotes he wants to share with us.
Yes, I do have two. I think actually one, it's better if I save it for a little closer to the awards season.
Okay.
And you'll see why. But the other one
Michael has one anecdote for us.
Yeah, I hope it'll be worth it. I went last night to see a production of A Man for All Seasons on Staten Island with a friend of mine, Charles Sullivan, as Sir Thomas More, and he was really excellent in it. But I traveled with a whole bunch of theater friends, a bunch of people that I used to do theater with on Staten Island many moons ago. One of them is Leah Rowasio, a really great actress. Her sister, Adrian, whom I work with actually at my day job. Our friend, Adi Ferretti. We did high school shows. We did, some of us, we did college community theater. And then Frank Lombardi was the last member of the group, and he was the creator of The Nanny. On TV, he went on to create The Nanny. But anyway, so we're talking, and you can imagine the nonstop talk, and we're having so many laughs. But somehow, I think Frank brought up, we're talking about movies that we loved, and he said, oh, you know, there was that great movie with James Coco. They all laughed. And then somebody else is like, no, not they all laughed. That's not James Coco. And then somebody else said, oh, you mean Laughter on the 23rd Floor. And somebody else said, no, that's not it. And then, and finally, we realized it's Only When I Laugh. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that movie. It's supposed to be really great with James Coco and all these other people. All right, so fine. So then after the play, we were driving home and talking about the play. And I mentioned that, well, you know, I had just seen Frank Langella in A Man for All Seasons on Broadway not too many years ago. And I said, oh, you know, he's so great on stage. And something he was else that I saw him in that he was really great in was Enter Laughing. And everyone is like, not Enter Laughing. And I said, and then I said, oh, I mean Present Laughter.
Yeah.
So we're all laughing at the fact that we can't come up with these titles, and all of the titles have laughter in the title. And we were just like screaming in the car. It was just so funny. I guess maybe you had to be there, but it was.
You know, you mentioned that immediately, and this is how great Frank Langella is. You just mentioned Present Laughter and Frank Langella, and I immediately have this vision in my head of him standing there in this bathrobe looking at himself in the mirror.
And his tie and his hair.
Yes, it just prints. And I laugh to myself immediately just thinking that's how great Frank Langella is and that how lucky we are to see him.
And so often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So often.
Mm-hmm. So great.
On stage, and then, you know, he had that brilliant film comeback, I guess maybe you'd say, with Frost Nixon.
Yeah,
and he's on television. Yeah, The Americans.
Yeah.
See, as a non-TV watcher, I don't even know that, but that's great.
And Jan brings up he's 78, and I was when she said you said that before, right?
You said
he was 7, and I thought to myself, this is not possible.
Yeah,
he can't be 7, and he absolutely is, but he's just timeless, timeless. I was thinking, before when we were talking about the father. I was thinking to myself, it was one of the points I was going to make, but I got overwhelmed by the lighting, was that I would love to see him in China Doll, to see if he did something different in China Doll that would make that show interesting to me.
That's a really interesting idea.
Well, I just think the play was...
The play is tough. The play is tough,
yeah.
But I felt like Al Pacino played it all at one level.
Yes.
And true. That's very difficult. So I wonder how Frank Langella would have done that differently and if it would have worked a little, but that the underlying piece is tough. It's very tough. All right. So let's wrap up right now. We're not going to have any trivia, but I would like to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio. There's a subscribe link that way. Each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Get us streamed to you. Broadway World Radio plays this week on Broadway on Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Jan, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including a number of videos. We have Kristen Chenoweth and Andrew Lippa, and I am Ann Hutchinson, I am Harvey Milk, not I am Anne Hathaway, I am Harvey Milk, as I said before. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof video. We have 110 in the Shade video. We have video from the Pipeline Festival and a bunch of other things. So check out BroadwayRadio.com, ThisWeekOnBroadway.com, and you can find those things pretty easily. And
you know what? I think someone should write, I am Ann Harada.
Ann Harada. Oh, Michael.
Yes.
Totally unrelated to I Am Ann Harada, during the opening segment, we didn't talk about Sound of Musicals.
Oh, yes. Our second edition has just been published, and it's me offering a review with excerpts of some of my favorite recordings of one of my favorite of all time shows, The King and I. So you can definitely check that out on Broadway Radio.
I'm going to edit that back into the beginning so that people listen to it, because sometimes people tune out at the credits. So if you don't listen to the credits, you're not a big nerd. So on behalf of Jan Simpson and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, rain, 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 rain,